Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, sports fans. This is Ryan Stern, and you are listening to Beyond the Benches. Good evening, sports fans. It is Sunday night, June 9th, and it is a beautiful day out today. How's everyone doing? I am Ryan Stern, and I will be with you for the next hour. If you want to join us, please feel free to call in at 646-283-0846. Once again, 646-283-0846. I'll be taking you through a quick run around the world of sports. We'll start off with a little bit of NBA basketball, as that's the big thing that's going on right now. We're about a minute left in the first quarter. The Heat have a one-point lead on the San Antonio Spurs, 20-19. I had a feeling this would be a tough series for the Heat to win, especially the way that the big three turned into a big one during the Pacers series. Chris Bosh has been absolutely nowhere to be found. He has been horrible for the last eight or so games. And that compiled with what Dwayne Wade has been doing. I know he's battling a knee injury, and it's tough to play through what he's going through, but still, this is the finals now. Dwayne Wade has to step up. It cannot all be about LeBron. If the other two can't step up and have the series that the rest of the world is expecting them to have, it's going to be a quick one. One, because I feel that the San Antonio Spurs are a much better offensive team than the Indiana Pacers. I don't think anybody denies that. I also don't think that there is that big of a defensive difference between the two. I mean, the Indiana Pacers were probably considered throughout most of the season to be the best defensive team in the league this year. San Antonio Spurs have the experience and they have the coaching to know how to win basketball games. Greg Popovich, where if he wins this series, which I believe in best of seven series, when he's won the first game, this is now the 21st series that he's won the first game. The first 20, the Spurs are 17-3. Now, I know this is a different animal playing the defending champion and maybe the best team in the league with the Heat, but Greg Popovich is about to put himself into rare air. You're looking at now a coach who is trying to win his fifth title, and it would be in 14 years. That's not too bad. Five titles in 14 years. That's close to being considered a dynasty. I know the Lakers have won a bunch in that time as well. But if you're going to win five in 14 years, it's close to being a dynasty. I believe the only coaches who have five championships in the NBA are Pat Riley, Red Auerbach, and Phil Jackson. So now you're talking about someone who is going to become or try to become the fourth most winningest the fourth winningest coach in NBA Finals history. I think it's time we start to give Greg Popovich the credit that he deserves. Tim Duncan isn't the Tim Duncan of old, but he doesn't have to be. The reason why the Spurs have a great shot at winning this series is because of the team that they've built around him. It's plain and simple. The Spurs have players that can contribute on both ends of the floor. The Heat don't. The Heat have some players who are good on the offensive end. They have some players who are good on the defensive end. They don't have the depth throughout the lineup that the San Antonio Spurs have. I picked before the series started, I picked the Spurs to win in six. So I know it's tough to ask a team to beat the Miami Heat, who won 27 games in a row, to beat them four times in six games. I think they can do it. We're now at the end of the first quarter, and it's tied at 22. So it looks as though this is going to go down to the wire, just as game one did. And you know what? The NBA needs it. The NBA needs, in my opinion, a team that can battle the Heat. I don't think that it becomes fun, especially fun to watch, when you have a team like San Antonio who's not going to wow you with their amazing talent. They're not a high-flying team. They're not going to be a team that's going to beat you on the fast break the way that the Heat can. They are going to try and bore you. They're going to they're going to take the whole advantage of the 24-second clock. They're going to play a lot of switch defense that's going to make it very hard for teams to play against offensively. They're going to have either soft or hard doubles on LeBron throughout the series, as long as you don't see someone like Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, Mike Miller, or Mario Chalmers step up on the offensive side of the floor. They're going to double LeBron all series long. Make someone else beat you, and that's the right thing to do. The New Jersey Nets are in search of a head coach. I'm sorry, the Brooklyn Nets. It just happens to... I get stuck in that all the time. The Brooklyn Nets are in search of a head coach, and what is the report that comes out today? Jason Kidd, the newly retired Jason Kidd, who spent his final year with the rival New York Knicks, Jason Kidd wants to be the coach of the Brooklyn Nets. I'd like to know what everyone feels about that. If you want, you can, once again, give us a call, 646-283-0846. Let me know how you feel about Jason Kidd trying to make the direct step from being an NBA player to being an NBA coach. You can try and hit us up on Twitter. You can either send a tweet to my personal account. You can find me at rstern33bsp, or you can follow the show on Twitter at Beyond the Bench. Once again, I'm at rstern33bsp, or you can follow the show at Beyond the Bench. We are produced today by Back Sports Page, and we thank them for everything that they do for us. My thoughts on Jason Kidd trying to become a coach right away. Let it sit for a little bit. Let it sit. There's no need, especially when you're coming from a team that is considered a rival. I know a lot of people try and play off the whole Knick-Net rivalry. But when both teams are good, especially now with the Nets being in Brooklyn and there being the whole New York tie, and it's not a New York-New Jersey thing, it's now a borough thing, I think it's going to be a decent rivalry. I don't think that it's right for Jason Kidd right now to step in as a coach. I think he needs to take a year away from the game, be an analyst, be an assistant coach. You cannot be a head coach the year after you retire. That's my opinion. Let's take a look at the scoreboard. Earlier today in baseball, you had the Mets losing another extra inning game to the Miami Marlins. This is a day after they lost a 20-inning game 2-1. They went 0-4-19 with runners in scoring position. It seems as if the Mets took their four-game sweep of the Yankees, and everyone said that's their World Series. That everyone says for the Mets this year, their World Series is going to be beating the Yankees. They did that. And they have been absolute junk ever since. They lose a 20-inning game. They blow a masterful performance by Matt Harvey, and then an even more masterful performance by Sean Markham in relief. The two of them throw a combined 15 innings, allowing two runs. I mean, it's amazing how the Marlins now have 18 wins on the season. Eight of them are against the Mets. Eight of their 18 wins on the entire season. Now, you do the math. That is almost half of their wins are against the Mets. Today they score four runs in the top of the 10th and beat the Mets 8-4. You have the Texas Rangers coming from behind. They were down 4-0 early on in the game, come back to beat the Blue Jays 6-4. You have the hot Detroit Tigers over the Cleveland Indians 4-1. You have the Boston Red Sox who, hey, you got to give a lot of credit to the Boston Red Sox. Everyone was picking them to finish last in the AL East, and it wasn't, that definitely wasn't out of the realm of possibility because of how they played last year, and then with the trade of their big stars, they traded Adrian Gonzalez, Josh Beckett, Carl Crawford. Who knew that David Ortiz was going to be an MVP candidate? They are now 14 games over 500 after they beat the Anaheim Angels 10-5. Now, the Anaheim Angels are the exact opposite of the Boston Red Sox. Everyone was picking the Angels to win the West, win the World Series. They are now 9 games under 500. You have the Washington Nationals with a 7-0 blanking over the Minnesota Twins. The Milwaukee Brewers outslugged the Philadelphia Phillies 9-1 in Milwaukee. The Orioles squeaked by the Tampa Bay Rays 10-7. You have the Cubs with a 4-1 victory over the Pirates. Chicago White Sox with a 4-2 win over the hot Oakland Athletics, the Kansas City Royals, and the Houston Astros. There's a game that says national spotlight all over it. The Royals with a 2-0 win over the Astros. The Atlanta Braves continue to roll along as they pound on the slumping Dodgers 8-1. Colorado Rockies in 10 innings with the 8-7 walk-off victory against the Padres. The Yankees, with a run in the top of the ninth, make a winner out of David Robertson. Mariano Rivera with his 23rd save, and the Yankees beat the Mariners 2-1. Right now we have in the second inning the Reds with a 2-0 lead over the Cardinals in a matchup of NL Central powerhouses. And in the top of the fifth, the Minnesota Twins with a 4-2 lead over the Nationals in the second game of their doubleheader. Let's go around the majors for a little bit. What are some surprises that we've encountered this year? I brought up the Red Sox. I brought up the Angels. How about the Nationals? Washington Nationals were everyone's pick to come out of the National League. They're now a game under 500 and losing right now halfway through the game to the Minnesota Twins. They're in danger of falling to 2 games under 500. The Braves are starting to pull away. They're the only team in the National League East that have a winning record. They're 15 games over 500. They have a 9-game lead over the second-place Nationals. It's time for the Nationals to step up and become the team that everyone thought they were going to be. I know they're a little injury-ridden. Bryce Harper with his knee, Steven Strasburg, I believe, with his hamstring. The reason why everyone thought the Nationals were going to be the class of the NL East was their depth. Their depth has been non-existent this year. So that's one of my big surprises. Another one of my surprises is the Los Angeles Dodgers. And the Dodgers are in a tough division. The NL West doesn't get enough credit for being as competitive as it really is. And the Diamondbacks, this is now the second season in a row that they're quietly making their name. No one ever talks about the Diamondbacks. We're talking about the Giants because they won the World Series last year and they're always near the top of the division. We're talking about the Dodgers because of the money they spent towards the end of last year and this offseason. But it's teams like the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Colorado Rockies, who are only a game and a half out, that are making this division one of the better ones in the game. The big surprise for me is that the Oakland Athletics were able to take their surprise season from last year and build on it. I thought that they were going to be that team that had the one good year and then would fall back to irrelevancy the way that they had been the past couple years. Boy, was I wrong. There are 11 games over 500, a half game out of first place behind the Texas Rangers. And they're 10 games ahead of the Angels, who are in third place in that absolutely putrid division that is the AL West. Over in the Central, the Tigers, and I think we all picked the Tigers to win that division. The Indians were a nice story. They've now lost 7 in a row. They went from being 5 games over 500 to 2 games under. I didn't think the Cleveland Indians were going to be any good. I was expecting more from the Kansas City Royals. They've had a nice little 5-game winning streak to bring them back close to 500. They're still 4 games under. The Royals were going to be my surprise team in the AL. I thought the Royals were going to have finished the season over 500. Now, like I said, it's still early, somewhat early in the year. We're not even at the halfway point yet. But the Royals are 4 games under. I would love to see a team like that come from being one of the 3 worst teams for probably the last decade, if not the worst team over the last decade, and make a push. Now, I'm not expecting them to make a push at the Tigers. I think the Tigers are in a class of their own in the Central. I'd like to see the Royals make a push for a wild card. And over in the East, most people would consider the Toronto Blue Jays to be a surprise. They're 8 games under 500, 11 games out of first place. I picked the Toronto Blue Jays to finish. Their over-under was at 86. I picked them to finish under 86, and that wasn't even a slight hesitation on my point. I didn't think that the money that they spent, the trades that they made, were smart trades. They traded for a 38-year-old knuckleballer who, now mind you, as a Met fan, I loved R.A. Dickey. Absolutely loved him. Loved the energy that he brought to the field every time he went out. It was a spectacle every time he took the field at Citi Field. The only time anybody filled the seats over there in Flushing last year was when R.A. Dickey took the mound. But we have to look at what's real. He's 38, and he's had 3 good seasons in his career. They gave up the top catching prospect in all of baseball, and they gave up a pitcher who is now considered to be one of the top pitchers in the Mets system. He's the second best pitcher in the system behind Zach Wheeler, who will be up with the team over the next week or two. I have no doubt about it. I think that Zach Wheeler, now, he's been a little shaky, a little up and down, but they're, now that we're past all of those deadlines where now the Mets can control him for the 2 extra years, it's time to bring him up. But with what Toronto gave up for Dickey, they gave up Travis d'Arnaud, who broke a bone in his foot. He's out for another couple weeks. But they gave up Noah Syndergaard. Noah Syndergaard is mowing people down in the minor leagues. I wouldn't be surprised if you see him as a September call-up this year. Unless the Mets use him as trade bait to land a big outfielder. You got to figure that one of Zach Wheeler, Syndergaard, or Montero are going to be used in a trade for an outfielder. because what the Mets put out there on a consistent basis in that outfield is not right. Especially for a team in the market that is New York. You haven't even seen the Royals or Twins put out an outfield that is as bad as what they've put out. Now, Marlon Byrd's been a nice player. Has he been among the upper half of all outfielders this year? No. Lucas Duda has his moments. Has he been among the upper half of all outfielders this year? No. What the Mets consistently put out there is unacceptable. Now, I know there are a lot of people who say, hey, why can't we have in a year or two a rotation of Nice, Harvey, Wheeler, Syndergaard, Montero? That looks great. That I would have no problem if that's what they did in the near future. If that was your starting five in 2015, I think there would be a lot of buzz about the team. But the front office needs to put their money where their mouth is. They said that they're no longer in financial troubles, that they're going to be spending money starting this offseason. They have to put up or shut up. And it starts with building an outfield. It's so bad that the Mets don't even have prospects in the minors who are good enough to replace the guys that they currently have. Now, the Mets made big news earlier today. They sent down Ike Davis, Mike Baxter, and one of their relief pitchers, Carson. Ike Davis deserves this demotion. He does not deserve the blame for this season. Just doesn't. There isn't enough talent on this team for one person to be the blame of their troubles. However, like I said, he deserves to be demoted. There just comes a point where ineffectiveness is too much. And Ike Davis has been beyond that. He's been beyond ineffective. Now, when he was going through his slumps last year, at least he had his defense. His defense was still on par or better than most other first basemen, especially in the National League. Ike Davis is a real good defensive player. He hasn't brought enough to the table defensively this year to warrant him staying with his offensive troubles. When you average almost a strikeout and a half per game, it's enough. It's enough already. Ike, I love you. You need to go down and learn how to hit a curveball. If you have a decent enough curveball, you are going to get out Ike Davis right now. So, Wally Backman, please teach this guy how to hit a curveball. All of Queens is begging you, get this guy on track, because Ike Davis has the potential to be one of the better first basemen in Mets history. And the Mets have had some pretty good ones. I mean, just in my lifetime, I've gotten to see maybe two of the 10 best defensive first basemen. I've gotten to see Keith Hernandez and John Olerud. And the amount of gold gloves just won by those two players is more than most teams have ever seen in their existence. Keith Hernandez and John Olerud were also 300 hitters. Keith was around 279 for his career. Olerud was close to 290. Neither one had a lot of power, but they weren't asked to hit home runs because they were always producing runs. Ike Davis needs to be hitting home runs. When Ike Davis isn't hitting home runs, he's striking out. So, Ike, get yourself on track in Vegas. Use that dry air. Get some confidence. Hit some home runs. All right, buddy? Switching over to a little NHL hockey. We have our final set. We have an original six matchup. We have the Boston Bruins, who were 10 minutes away from not even getting out of the first round, taking on the Chicago Blackhawks, who almost had a bad call by a referee, have them lose in the first round as well. Now, the Toronto Maple Leafs were up 4-1 on the Bruins with 10.5 minutes left in the third. They lose the lead. Boston comes back, wins in overtime, game seven, bada bing. And now it's all of a sudden like the Boston Bruins are the 27 Yankees. They go and they roll through the Rangers. They go and they sweep the number one seed, Pittsburgh Penguins, who scored 2 goals in 4 games. Let's look at that. You have the Penguins, who averaged almost 4 goals a game during the regular season. 4 goals a game. And they only get 2 goals in 4 games. Who's to blame? Or who gets the credit? Do you give Tuukka Rask and the defense of Boston the credit? Or do you give the blame to Evgeny Malkin, to Sidney Crosby, to James Neal, to Chris Letang, to Pascal Dupuis, and all of the Pittsburgh Penguins who made themselves into an offensive juggernaut throughout the year? In my estimation, you got to give the credit to Boston. Mainly Tuukka Rask. Tuukka Rask, who was the reason that the Bruins beat the Rangers in the first 2 games, in the first 3 games. He was brilliant. Then all of a sudden he allows the goal to Carl Hagelin in game 4, where he stumbles, falls on his butt, stick gets caught in his pads, and the puck just trickles into the net. And then he has a horrible third period. Rangers are back in the series. And Tuukka Rask is now looked at as, is he really that good? Can he handle the pressure? He was the goalie that was in net when the Flyers came back from 3-0 in 2010 to beat the Bruins. It wasn't Tim Thomas, remember. Tuukka Rask was in net. And then he had a brilliant, absolutely brilliant Game 5 and stifled all of those critics. Then you have the double overtime game in Game 3 against Pittsburgh in the Eastern Conference Finals. Now, I know it's double overtime, and it was late in double overtime, so it was almost 100 minutes that were played. They stopped 53 out of 54 shots. That's not easy. 53 out of 54 shots. And as well as the Boston D played, he had to make some spectacular saves. one from point blank on James Neal, who established himself as one of the top goal scorers in the NHL over the past 2 years. One on a beautiful deke by Evgeny Malkin, where Rask stuck out the right leg and stopped him. And one on Sidney Crosby. Sidney Crosby was invisible this series. Invisible. I've never seen someone the likes of Crosby just absolutely fall apart and be just another guy. And he wasn't even just another guy. He had his shots. He had some shots. He had a couple nice passes. This wasn't the Sidney Crosby we all come to watch and come to admire. And I know a lot of people don't admire him because of his on-ice tactics. He whines a little bit, especially for someone who's a superstar. But you never saw Wayne Gretzky in four games disappear the way that Crosby did. You never saw Jagr, Lemieux disappear the way that Sidney Crosby did. It just doesn't happen. A lot of that credit goes to Zdeno Chara. Now, I was asked by a colleague of mine earlier this week, do I think Zdeno Chara is a Hall of Famer? And my initial reaction was, no, he hasn't done enough over his career. I then, that night, I went and I looked up some numbers. And now, mind you, the numbers aren't outstanding. For a defenseman, they're really good. And then you look at one of the statistics that does not get enough notoriety, and that's average time on ice. Zdeno Chara has averaged over the last 10 years almost 28 minutes a game. That's half the game. Nobody plays almost half the game. Forwards, real good forwards, get around 20 minutes a game. You're now looking at someone who gets almost 28 minutes a game. And Zdeno Chara plays against everybody's first line. So he's always playing against your Crosbys. He's always playing against your Ovechkins. He's always playing against your Nashes. He's always playing against your Kovalchuks. And then you have to look, he's been a captain for a long time, and that shouldn't go unnoticed as well. His leadership abilities and the way that the rest of the players on his team respect him and play for him shouldn't go unnoticed. He's been the captain of one Stanley Cup winning team. I think if the Boston Bruins go on to beat the Chicago Blackhawks this year, I think he locks himself up to be in the Hall of Fame. He might already be there now. I think he locks it up with a win over Chicago. All right, on to my predictions. I think this is going to be a wonderful series. I think we're going to see a six-game series, and I think we are going to see the Boston Bruins surprise everybody and beat the Chicago Blackhawks. 4-2. They get to lift the cup at home this time instead of being in Vancouver the way they did 2 years ago. They'll lift it up in front of their fans who, you know what? They deserve it. The Boston Bruins fans have been one of the loudest, most supportive teams that I've just from watching all these games. They've been among the best. They're a great group of fans. They're a passionate group of fans. And after going through what that city has gone through over the last couple months with the whole tragedy at the Boston Marathon and the events that happened afterwards, I think it would be a wonderful thing if they were able to lift the cup in front of those fans. I'm not a Boston guy by any means. But I will take the Bruins in six. Moving on to a little bit of Rangers talk. And the only thing that seems to be up in the air right now with the Rangers is the coaching situation. Who is going to be the next coach of the Rangers? We spoke with Charles Curtis, who covers the Rangers for NJ.com. And he seems to be in the mindset that Glenn Seder wants to make a big splash with a name. The biggest splash for the Rangers is going to be Mark Messier. It's not going to be... There wouldn't be any bigger splash than that. Number 11 is a god at the Garden. He's worshipped wherever he goes, but it is the wrong choice for a coach. I'm not doubting that he would be able to get the job done, that he'd be able to command the respect of the players, but a coach is always, as Glenn Sather said in his press conference after the firing of John Tortorella, every coach has a shelf life, especially in today's day where it's more of a business than it ever was. It would not be right for the Rangers to have to fire Mark Messier if the job doesn't get done. I think the smart move, and the move that I had brought up to Charles Curtis, and one that he thought was a pretty decent idea, I like the idea of bringing in Ken Jernander. And the Rangers are trying to make somewhat of a youth movement. They have a lot of players on the team or who will be on the team who have spent time in Hartford with the Wolfpack. They were the Wolfpack, then Connecticut Whale, now they're back to the Wolfpack. But a lot of the team has spent some time up there in Hartford, especially someone like Chris Kreider, who is the future of New York Rangers hockey. If there's anybody who knows Hartford hockey, it's Ken Jernander. Ken Jernander came up with the Binghamton Rangers in the late 90s. In the late 80s, early 90s, was part of the Binghamton Rangers, moved to the Civic Center, moved to the mall, and was a member of the Wolf Pack. Had a couple cups of coffee with the Rangers. He would be, in baseball terms, what would be known as a quadruple A player. A really, really good triple A player, or in this case, an AHL player, but just couldn't seem to make his mark as a player in the league. Ken Janander is an offensive-minded coach who knows the young players on this team. I believe he, after retirement, he spent time behind the benches as a coach with Hartford. He's also spent time in the front office as their GM. So Ken Janander is my number one choice for the team. If they're going to look to go outside outside the organization to bring in a new coach, I really think that the best fit would be Alain Vigneault. He was the Vancouver Canucks coach. He brings a high-octane offense, which is something that the Rangers need. They need something completely different from the system that John Tortorella implied. They have players who are good enough defensively and a goalie who is good enough to hold the fort to be able to put offensive pressure on teams the way that other teams put on the Rangers what seems like all the time. And I think there needs to be some overhauling with the roster. But it's going to start with getting the right system in place. And it needs to be an offensive system, and it needs to be a system that puts pressure on other teams the way other teams put pressure on the Rangers. I wish that there was a stat that was easily accessible that allowed us to see average time in offensive zones. Because from watching just about every single game over the last couple of years, especially while John Tortorella had been the coach of the Rangers, it seemed that other teams would be in the zone at a 2-to-1 ratio that the Rangers would be in the other team offensive zone. And this is on a nightly basis. So, Ken Janander, number one. Alain Vigneault, number two, and I want no part of Wayne Gretzky as my coach. No part of it. Very rarely do you see the superstar have a successful career as a coach. Wayne Gretzky has already failed at being an NHL coach. Now, not taking anything away from him being the greatest player of all time, and especially with the fact that he didn't have a great team in Phoenix, but he has not been successful at all at the coaching level in the NHL. I want no part of Wayne Gretzky being brought in to be the head coach. Of all of the 94 Rangers that are still involved with the team, if they're going to go that route, bring in Adam Graves, please. If we're going to go that route, especially you're looking at someone like Mark Messier, who has been the special assistant to the GM the past couple of years. The special assistant to the GM, not even as a coach. He's being trained to become the next GM of the team. And now all of a sudden he's in the running for coach. Adam Graves is out on the ice doing clinics for the Rangers all the time. What he brings to the table is an absolute no BS mentality. I think of all the guys that of the core four, you hear about the core four with the Yankees, where they had Jeter, Mariano, Pettit, and Bernie Williams. They were the core four. Rangers had that core four with Leach, Graves, Messier, Richter. Of those core four, Adam Graves makes the most sense to me. I don't hear his name being brought up as often as I think it should, especially when you hear all the Messier rumors. But if I were to go 94-team, Graves would be my choice. Get into a little bit of a little football talk. We still have the situation going on with the Giants. It's always been the talk about Victor Cruz. Victor Cruz is going to be a Giant. Victor Cruz has 10 days now to sign an extension before the Giants can lower the amount of his tender. Right now, the tender is at, well, I believe, $2.89 million for a year. If he doesn't sign before June 19th, the Giants can lower that to a 10% increase of salary from last year. That would put him around $610,000. So that's almost $2 million pay cut if he doesn't sign in the next 10 days that the Giants can put upon him. Victor Cruz is not going anywhere. I'm telling you this. He's not going anywhere. One, because of the tender. If he doesn't sign the tender this year, the Giants can then tender him again next year at the same rate. Because he will, even if he sits out, he doesn't gain a year of a year till unrestricted free agency. The Giants then have the option to franchise him for 2 years. So the Giants can hold him without going anywhere for 3 years. Even without him signing a long-term contract, Victor Cruz is going to be here for the next 3 years, barring he stays healthy. So Victor Cruz, to me, is not the big issue. The big issue right now is Hakeem Nicks. Why is Hakeem Nicks not at OTAs? At OTAs. Is it a contract issue? Because the first day that he didn't show up, it seemed as if it was a contract issue. Now, it's not a contract issue, it's a personal issue. If it's a personal issue, send an email. Send a text. There are many ways to get in touch with your coaching staff, with your front office, to tell them, I got some issues I got to take care of. I'm going to be at minicamp. Don't worry, I'm not holding out. Or anything like that. Hakeem Nicks is really, if you heard any of the interviews with Tom Coughlin, is getting under the skin of the coaching staff and the front office. And it's one thing that bothers me as a Giants fan. I would love to know the reasoning behind his absence from OTAs. And personally, I think Tom Coughlin wants to know because all reports are that he has no idea why. And he's mad at him. So, the next issue I would like to talk about is, we have a couple minutes left, is the substance abuse policy in the NFL. It seems that the NFL has a pretty widespread problem with Adderall. We have now had 3 Seattle Seahawks suspended this offseason for the use of Adderall. Josh Gordon, one of the few wide receivers that have done anything for the Cleveland Browns. And this is just among others. If Adderall is being used that often, we need to look at how we can go about this problem. If someone is clinically diagnosed with having ADD or ADHD, they need to be allowed to take medication that's prescribed by a doctor. Now, if someone gets caught with Adderall use and has not been clinically diagnosed, fine, suspend them, get rid of them. I'm fine with that. But if someone has that illness, and it is an illness, something needs to be done because there are too many players who are getting suspended for using a legal drug, especially if they are obtaining that drug through a prescription from a licensed doctor. So, I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I'd like to thank Backsports Page for producing today's show. I can log on, check out www.backsportspage.com. We're going to have some pretty interesting and cool interviews coming up over the next couple weeks. You're going to see Maurice Jones-Drew of the Jacksonville Jaguars, among others. We're going to see Randall Cunningham. Next week, on the show, I'm going to try and get our good pal, Sean Podine, to talk a little Stanley Cup Finals. Maybe we'll have a little bit of baseball talk as we start to shift towards the end of the NBA and NHL season and into the dead of summer with baseball. So, this is Ryan Stern. Once again, you can find me at rstern33bsp on Twitter. Also, follow me, follow the show at Beyond the Bench. Have a good night, everybody.